A number of his students supported Swami Kalananda in his dedication to astrological niceties. One particularly dear and unusual soul was Tilly, a widow who lived nearby and did most of the gardening for the ashrama. Tilly was a good gardener, but that alone cannot account for the relation that Swami had with her. It was unique, beyond the comprehension of anyone else. She shared her private world, lived in the dreams and visions she cherished of the past and for the future. Sri Ramakrishna was in the habit of visiting Tilly, as were Swamiji and many other astral entities. What she would say about her visions, as if it happened to everyone all the time, would shock and bemuse me into embarrassed silence. But not Swami. He would accept her and her ingenuous assertions, a bit self-flattering, just as they came. Tilly usually wore an ample white gown and a wide-brimmed floppy hat, as she did her pottering about the flowers and shrubs. Swami Kalananda had placed a framed photo of her, dressed in just that way, prominently on the wall of the dining room. She considered herself the denizen of a heavenly world, on loan to earth for assisting in the master's play. And Swami said yes. She was an alien, as it were, long before we became acquainted with the term. This devotee took a special liking to me and wrote me letters, at least annually, for the rest of her long life. There were at that time two girls, his disciples, of whom Swami was taking particular care. It was as if he thought of these two as candidates for monastic life. He took special pains to teach them scriptural wisdom and to guide the pattern and style of their life and thought. They were working girls, but as there was no convent, I believe Swami had attempted to get one sanctioned by the headquarters in India, but had been turned down. Swami made do as best he could, and with these two devoted young women, had an affectionate, very humorous, and lively-witted, almost motherly relationship. At the very end of his life, before his successor had arrived, they lived in number 68 for a period of months, and helped to take care of their teacher. The effect and influence of the labor of these Swamis, who worked at deeper levels, quietly in their own corner of the world, is easily overlooked or minimized. Those who came, as I did, in the last phase of Muswell Hill Center, could have no comprehension of what had taken place there. It is a story one has to doubt will ever be written, or could be. The aura of peace and goodwill, the intensity of aspiration in its level of vibration, were the fruit of years of careful tending and of heart-rending self-denial on the part of his workers and disciples. It is a record to be found not only in the lives of those he reached and touched. He tended the fire of the furnace in which those lives were forged, and without them it is easy to lose in the dry dust of time all trace of the testimony of the consummate contribution to Vedanta in the West, made at the house on Duke's Avenue. I do not exaggerate. Because such persons do not talk about themselves as the ones we all know or want to do, this early stage of a spiritual foundation always remains veiled. I have seen it in every chapter of this book. As one who chanced upon Muswell Hill wrote, "The immediate environment was not particularly lavish. One might almost say it was more than a trifle dilapidated. But the impact was such that one of our party remarked, 'This is the place for us.' And from that moment, our search had ended. Swami Kanananda's students were impressive." How pulseless he could be, like cold steel. And if the blade of that disapproval pried between your ribs, take care. I remember once I stood in a room examining, a little uneasily, something that I realized was not exactly my business. His footsteps creaked the floorboards outside, and I supposed he was bound elsewhere, but soon I became aware that the footsteps were going forth and back, not far from the slightly open door. Then he abruptly entered the office where I stood, looked me up and down, and asked crisply, "May we help you?" I found some lame excuse to drop the matter in hand. It was the official list of the journal subscribers that I was looking at. "That is not your concern yet. That time will come," he said. The edge of his voice had gone straight through me, and I can never forget it. Had he been watching through the crack of the door? He didn't always need eyes to see, as we well knew. Swami Kanananda could use a tone, a wink, a gesture, a guffaw, a slanted word to marvelous effect. A cat under ashes, as a monastic disciple used to describe him. Yet the house on Duke's Avenue was permeated by love. I would go to bed and feel blissfully carried off to sleep. A feeling of nearness, of the saturating presence of affection, would steal over me at unexpected times. It was something I had not experienced since my days with Swami Ashokananda. I think now of Swami Kanananda as a fulfiller of desires. Odd as it may sound, like the fabled Kalpataru, the tree of Indian lore, supposed to bear as fruit whatever is desired by the one who finds it and stands under it, he could make dreams come true. He made many come true for me, and it seemed to be his joy to do so, though he seldom allowed anyone to catch him in that enjoyment. How many times we saw him hiding that sweet grin which made his eyes seem to dance, behind a paper or a book, as if to say, "I know that you have appreciated what I have given you, but let us not speak of it." It was difficult to thank him for anything. He was too humble for that. Not that he turned deferentially away from thanks. Something in his manner just forestalled it. It was some years later that I remembered in this connection the confession of Sri Maharaj, Swami Brahmananda. Quote, "If I love a man, I never let him know of it." It was Swami Kanananda who initiated public work for me. It was then I realized why he had been willing to bring me to England. He had other plans for Swami Parahitananda, his English assistant, and I, though but a brahmachari, would have to assume most of the latter's tasks, editing, giving discourses, interviews. So a tryout was held. Swami told me, "Prepare a talk, and Edna, the treasurer mentioned above, and I will come and listen." Choosing the title Vedanta, a strength-giving religion, I tried to model my thoughts and their development on those of Swami Ashokananda, my ideal lecturer. It was delivered one evening in the lecture hall, made as usual by the throwing together of two large rooms on the ground floor. And sure enough, I had an audience of two. Both liked the lecture and gave appropriate suggestions. At least Swami said it was satisfactory, and this pronouncement opened a whole new direction for my monastic labors. It was disturbing, however, suddenly to be asked to preach, even though we carefully cultivate the underlying realization that it is Brahman in the speaker who is in the act of worshipping Brahman in the listener. It was sufficiently disturbing that I believed I had to write a letter to the vice president of the order at Belur, a senior Swami known to me, asking him how I could deliver lectures in view of what the master had said about the blind leading the blind. I had no divine command. Swami Nirvanananda wrote back at once in a loving and understanding vein. "Certainly you are not going to preach of your own accord," he reminded me. "You have been asked to do so by the authority there, and he is deputed by the order, and I think that is the badge of authority. You are not going to give talks with the idea of preaching. You will do it as the service of the Lord and as a part of your sadhana. Work is worship, and any work can be looked upon as worship. Work done in the proper spirit will become worship, and that helps the aspirant to march forward. You can serve the Lord and humanity with whatever you have and simply do your best." End of the letter. Soon I was sent to speak outside the city as well, in answer to requests made to Swami by various groups. He sent me now to live at Holland Park. From among the many empty rooms, I chose number 10, where I had stayed on my brief visit earlier. We went to and fro, the one house to the other, and not always in the car. When one took the tube, subway, the usual terminal north was Highgate. This means a confrontation with the famous Highgate Cemetery. One had to walk alongside it for some distance, and as it was often in the news, either for current dire happenings or for some ancient mischief, I would try to keep high thoughts in mind and whistle a tune. End of section.